Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome, everyone, to special New Year's Eve edition of Your Case is on Hold. This is rockin' New Year's Eve live from Times Square that is neither live nor recorded on Times Square nor recorded on New Year's Eve. But nonetheless, we're sharing that sentiment as we bring in 2025. Hopefully you are listening to us the day we drop, December 31st. Counting down to 2025 for the January 1st issue, the inaugural issue of the 2025 year for JBJS. This is episode 73. I have so many things to cover for our rockin' New Year's Eve experience. I'm afraid I'm going to forget. But this is Andrew and Antonia live in Times Square for the New Year's Eve, brought to you by the Nakatomi Corporation. Actually, this is brought to you by JBJS CME. There's still time this holiday season or to kick off 2025 for you to get all your CME needs met at the beginning of the year. Definitely head to jbjs.org. Make sure that you are subscribed to JBJS CME so you can get credit for listening to us, taking the self-assessment exams, doing the subspecialty exams, doing clinical classroom, all your needs met. Just one single bundle. One-stop shopping.
Just like we have one-stop shopping here for a rocking New Year's Eve.
That's right. I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. I have with me
Antonia Chen, deputy editor for Adult Reconstruction.
And everything that we're covering here for this rocking New Year's Eve episode is, as always, our own opinions and not those of any of the other editorial board members at the Journal. So it's not just us here for our lineup for Rockin' New Year's Eve. We have all the highlights of JBJS from the last year. We've got Kaiser Soze with us. Jackie Childs is here. The Soprano family. Reviewer 2, Ortho Bro, C. Zachary Chadson, the Skull and Bones Singers. We got Mariah Carey, Terrence and Phillip. Brooke Shields live from the set of Blue Lagoon, among others. There'll be some special guest appearances or Easter eggs or who knows what, so stay tuned. If you haven't already, which we hope you have, be sure to like and subscribe, get the notification bell, give us a 5-star rating, find us on Stitcher, Spotify, Castos, Apple, jbjs.org, YouTube, or wherever else you happen to get your podcasts. I think we're everywhere. Let's get into it. Top of the pile, the impact of sustained outreach efforts on gender diversity and orthopedic surgery by Buckley. Anterior glenohumeral instability, clinical anatomy, clinical evaluation, imaging, non-operative and operative management, and postoperative rehabilitation by Marcaccio. What's important? Engaging meaningfully with sustainability efforts as an orthopedic surgeon by Belair, permanently free. Muscle compensation strategies to maintain glenohumeral joint stability and rotator cuff tears, a cadaveric study by Hoshikawa. Early stage femoral head hypoperfusion correlates with femoral head deformity at intermediate follow-up in leg Calvé-Perthes disease by Kang. Radiographic outcome following treatment of residual hip dysplasia with Pemberton versus Salter osteotomy. Comparison of results in patients followed to skeletal maturity by Sukato. Then we have identifying predictors of successful conversion from OREF grants to federal funding among orthopedic surgeons by Lee. And the disruptive physician, Bad Apple or Toxic Tree. There's an intriguing title by Ramirez. That's where we're at with the top of the pile. Now let's get into the headlines. What's as we turn the page on 2024 in the orthopedic field. Effect of ketorolac administration on the rate of non-union of operatively treated pediatric long bone fractures, a matched cohort analysis. This is by Pereira and colleagues. It is 30 days free, so you don't have to just take it from me. Be sure to check it out at no cost to you for the next 30 days. This is a study entering, wading into the murky waters of the use of non-steroidals in the treatment of fractures, for which there's a lot of information, misinformation, disinformation, depending on who you ask. So these authors felt that they could weigh in into these controversies by using TriNext research network data, which comes from the United States, Canada, and Western Europe. The patients that they included were those less than 18 with operatively managed upper or lower extremity long bone fractures who were exposed to ketorolac within 30 days postoperatively. Now, this was done over the course of a 20-year time window, 2003 to 2023, which is pretty extensive and does raise some concerns about the evolution of surgical procedures and the risk of non-union that may be changing over time, as well as potentially proclivity to use the non-steroidals. Now, they did use propensity score matching, and they included age, biologic sex, race, body mass index, fracture pattern, and the use of analgesics in the model. I don't see that they included the year of the surgery or potentially different types of surgical interventions in the model. And I do think that is important. They did follow best practices as far as evaluating the balance with standardized mean differences, and they have a fairly restrictive caliper at 0.1. So all of that is good. The findings do show that the incidence of non-union was about 2%, a little bit higher in the group exposed to ketorolac, and less than 1% in the non-ketorolac group. So the hazard there is about 2.7, which is definitely significant. They also found that there was a higher risk of non-union in individuals with lower extremity fractures, and the greatest were in patients with femoral fractures, followed by tibial or fibular fractures, and then the upper extremity fractures, which had lower risk. So the authors are saying that it's important to weigh the therapeutic advantages of non-opiate analgesia with ketorolac against the risk of non-union in order to optimize postoperative pain management and recovery. So there is some risk. They're careful to emphasize that non-union is rare, occurring in less than 1% of all included patients overall. But there does seem to be a more sizable risk with ketorolac. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the same for other types of non-steroidals. I think that harkens back to some of the original findings of non-union after fractures were in patients who are exposed to high-dose indomethacin. And that doesn't necessarily translate to if you're using ibuprofen, for example. Obviously, the risk of non-union is going to vary widely based on baseline likelihood and other confounding effects that I don't feel are controlled for in a very compelling way in this analysis, given that it spans 20 years. It includes a variety of patients treated in a variety of different contexts and who also have potentially other confounding factors that are not measured or included in this analysis that relies, you know, almost exclusively on coding-based practice. You don't have information on their, you know, other comorbidities or what was driving the decision to use ketorolac. I don't think that age, sex, race, BMI, maybe fracture pattern, but very few of the other factors that they're considering in their propensity score match are really getting at the true clinical drivers of decisions to use ketorolac or balancing the risk, if it was even perceived or understood at baseline, for non-union in the setting of ketorolac versus not. So I think those are concerns. I also, this may be a soapbox moment or not, you know, they say this is the largest study to date to explore postoperative ketorolac use and non-union. I mean, you know, there's the largest study to date, and then there are the largest studies to date. When you have obviously a database that has like a whole bunch of claims in it, you're going to get thousands and thousands of patients. That's not the same as, you know, having a real granular encapsulation of the clinical parameters and the drivers for non-union that you would have. You know, say you put together a very comprehensive cohort of patients replicating these approaches with like 1,000 in the ketorolac arm and 1,000 in the non. And so you just have 2,000 patients. I think that kind of study would actually trump the 48,000 patients included here due to the lack of granularity. I would encourage authors into 2025, here's a New Year's resolution, we don't need this language around this is the largest study to date, because then, you know, there'll be another data set with 48,779 patients, and that would be the largest study to date. And then there'd be another one with 50,000 patients, and that would be the largest study to date. Once you get beyond, you know, a couple thousand patients, I don't think we need to be sort of using the Herald's trumpet for this is the largest study or that's the largest study. We don't care about the numbers if the clinical granularity is not that robust. Would you agree?
1,000% agree. I was actually surprised to see that in the abstract even, because typically sometimes that might come up in the discussion or something like that, like comparative to other studies that are listed out there. But I typically do not put something like that for a database study for exactly that reason. It's not study patients that I've had to go recruit, you know, randomize or things like that, that, you know, really, or even a retrospective study, right? Where you're looking at an esoteric condition in a cohort in a single institution. So you just can't get granular or detailed about this data. So I 1,000% agree with you.
All right. Yeah. I mean, if you're doing that kind of stuff, it just sort of comes across as hyperbole, I think. But let's get into one of those granular prospective randomized studies with your headline on the outcomes following transtibial amputation with and without a tibiofibular synostosis procedure, a multicenter randomized clinical trial, the TAOS study by Bossi and colleagues. There is an infographic, and this is also 30 days free.
This is one of those studies where the gift that keeps on giving, the Major Extremity Trauma Research Consortium, or METRIC, is fantastic, and they produced another great study, including 25 centers. And in this study, they compared outcomes between patients who underwent transtibial amputation with and without a tibiofibular synostosis procedure at 18 months. And they followed these patients for the 18-month period. Synostosis, for those of us who don't do this on a regular basis, in combination with transtibial amputation, can be controversial. It basically, the idea is you're trying to create potentially a stable and a shape-based weight-bearing capability of a transtibial amputation. So you're amputating across the tibia. So you want to create fusion essentially across that area of the terminal residual limb, which in theory could result in less pain and improve prosthesis fit, but it's not ideal to cut right across there. That said, it's an additional step and it could increase the risk of complications after surgery. So the purpose of this randomized controlled trial is to compare the 18-month rate of reoperation for complications and patient-reported functions between patients who underwent transtibial amputation with and without a tibiofibular synostosis procedure following lower extremity trauma between May 2013 and September 2018. So the interesting thing is that the patients have primary outcome of operative treatment for a complication or revision within 18 months of amputation and the short musculoskeletal function assessment, which is the SMFA scores. This includes a bother and dysfunction index along with mobility, daily activities, arm and hand function, and emotional function domains. Secondary outcomes of the study included components of the first primary outcome, such as number of reoperations and number of readmissions for complications, the number of non-operatively treated complications, pain using a brief pain inventory and phantom limb pain, prosthesis use, the number of hours worn per week, and satisfaction with the prosthesis. And patients were included if the residual limb wasn't fractured or fracture was stabilized in the terminal fixation, if the proximal tib-fib joint was uninjured or stabilized, the soft tissue coverage allowed for a typical closure or atypical closure with a skin graft of less than 100 centimeters squared, and the residual limb length was greater than 10 centimeters from the joint line to the end of the tibia. Patients were placed in one-to-one block randomization, and the primary analysis were the randomized controlled trial patients. However, they had patients who refused to undergo randomization to the two categories, and this included approximately 93 patients, 31 patients who got synostosis, and 61 patients who were treated by non-synostosis. And in a secondary analysis, they looked at the randomized controlled patients and these kind of observational patients that refuse to be randomized. Now, note here that the sample size calculation for RCT was based on testing of the primary hypothesis regarding surgical complications and patient-reported function. And the planned sample size in this randomized controlled trial was 107 per arm. That said, at the end of the day, the study population started with 120 patients, not 107 patients in each arm, of which 14 were ineligible after randomization. So there was a final total of 106 patients aged 18 to 60 years old who were treated with without. So there was 52 patients in the without synostosis group and 54 patients in the with synostosis group. during unilateral transtibial amputation, and again with this 18-month follow-up. So the follow-up regarding reoperation for the complication was 94% of the expected person time through the 18 months for the synostosis group and 91% for the non-synostosis group. The primary RCT analysis, and for looking at the primary RCT analysis, the probability of greater one or greater operatively treated complications was higher for the synostosis group at 42% than the non-synostosis group, which was 24%, with an absolute risk difference of 18%. Looking specifically at this patient reported outcome score, SMFA, the bother scores were pretty similar and the dysfunction scores were pretty similar. There are also no appreciable differences in mean SMA scores for mobility, daily activities, emotional harm, and arm and hand function domains. The rate of reoperation for a complication was higher for patients in the synostosis group than for the non-synostosis groups, but these differences were coupled with appreciable uncertainty, specifically given the sample size. There were no appreciable differences in patient-reported pain, prosthesis use, and satisfaction. When they did a secondary combined analysis, remember the randomized control group with the observational group, the probability of an operatively treated complication was larger in patients who also underwent a synostosis, which reflected the findings from the RCT, and the absolute risk difference here was a little bit larger, which is 26.1. Bigger differences in SMFA scores, and it favored synostosis for domains such as dysfunction, mobility, and daily activities, but there were no differences in pain, prosthetic use, and satisfaction. And results were comparable with the primary analysis in regards to readmission, but there were larger differences in reoperation for synostosis. So the biggest concern for me with this study, while it's a metric study, has 25 different groups, it's randomized, and typically encompasses procedures such as transtibial amputation that are harder to do in a single center and get a large number of patients, is that the trial didn't reach target enrollment. There's supposed to be, again, 107 patients per arm. There's only a total of 106 patients in both groups combined. And there's also a 13% crossover risk for patients randomized to the synostosis procedure, which is driven by surgeon or patient treatment preferences. They did use an intention to treat analysis and an as treated analysis, and they found no differences in these results. But you would really hope that they would first give an explanation as to why they terminated the study early. I would also expect that the randomized controlled trial and the observation study to have same results, especially since they were done in the same time period with the same surgeons, including the SMFA scores. Now, some of these factors were different enough to meet the minimally clinically important difference of 7 for these score domains. So the observation group may not be fully representative of the study patients, which really encouraged me to say that they should have enrolled more patients in the randomized controlled trial to make a really strong finding. So I would like to know why that the study ended early. Likely it ran from 2013 to 2018 and maybe enrollment was stagnant, but it would be nice to address that. So I do take the study with a grain of salt, but it is a larger patient population given the study group that we're looking at.
I would say that we're starting the year off with this one going on hold for a couple of reasons. One, I can't reconcile the as the one meet their enrollment. And they didn't meet their enrollment goals, but it's not, we're not just talking about 10 difference. It's by about half. So that's one. Second, their main findings, obviously the confidence intervals are fairly wide, as would be expected, study power. And they give the point estimates of 42% for the synostosis versus 24% for the non synostosis, but the confidence intervals overlap by quite a bit. And the absolute risk difference has a lower bound 95% confidence interval that's essentially zero. It's 0.31%. And then that goes all the way up to 36% with a point estimate that's like right in the middle. If you're just looking at the confidence intervals and comparing these, there's quite a bit hard to make heads or tails of the findings, certainly not to the point where we would consider them clinically actionable when you have an underpowered study. So then they do the secondary analysis with the combined RCT and the observational participants. And then they do find the absolute risk difference at 26%. But then the SMFA scores, they favor synostosis, but there are no like real differences that they can put there as far as pain, prosthetic use, satisfaction. So I think that there are a lot of unanswered questions here, and it's very hard to understand what the driving motivating factors are when you you have all of these other confounders. I would not present this as level one evidence. I don't think you know, there's some signals there, but I don't think you can use this to really inform clinical care. That's my take on it.
Yeah, I want to like this because it's a metric study, but there is a lot to be left wanting for the study. Completely agree.
All right, so that's one. Will there be two? The Your Case is on Hold featurette for our Rockin' New Year's Eve, defining the cost of arthroscopic rotator cuff repair, a multi-activity-based costing and cost optimization investigation by Fedorka and colleagues, with an infographic, 30 days free. So once again, you should read it, not just take our word for it, check it out for yourself. So this is among a growing number of studies. The propensity score match of 2024 is going to now be the time-driven activity-based costing analysis 2025. I'm seeing a burgeoning number of studies using this type of analytic approach, kind of percolating up from the undergrowth of our research submissions.
So I think that in the context of a newly released movie, Wicked, it's popular. So I'm not going to sing it, but I'm just saying.
It is popular. Yep. Yep. It is, absolutely. We forgot to mention Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo are here for our Rockin' New Year's Eve as well. This is going to try and defy gravity, but I think I'm going to bring it down.
Well done.
So the aim of this study is to apply time-driven activity-based costing analysis to rotator cuff procedures to identify specific avenues to optimize cost efficiency within the healthcare system in two areas: reduction of variation in the episode duration, and then standardization of suture anchor acquisition costs. Their substantiation is that while there have been several studies, of which they list four, that have been published on this very fact using TDABC methodology in RCR, each of those studies analyzed data from a single institution. So although they did report cost estimates for rotator cuff, they say it's likely accurate only for their own institution and lacks external generalizability. That's all well and good. Looked to do a multi-center study. So what did they get? Did they get 50 centers, 1,000 centers? How many centers did they get to kind of, you know, really get at this in a granular way? They got four centers. Not one center. The other ones are bad. They only did one. They did four. So this is...
Variety is a spice of life.
Well, this just seems very incremental to me. Incremental incidental. They got four academic tertiary health systems. As we've discussed in the past, when people put this academic appellation, that could mean different things to different people. I don't know what it means. If you look at the author list, there are many more authors and institutions than there are four academic centers. So, you know, MGH is represented, Newton Wellesley is represented, Johns Hopkins is represented, Thomas Jefferson is represented. And someone at Newton Wellesley saying it's an academic medical center versus somebody at MGH or Johns Hopkins or even Thomas Jefferson saying it's an academic medical center, I think those are all very different academic medical centers on a number of different levels. But they only had 921 actual cases performed across the four institutions with a mean episode duration cost of about $4,000. Unclear why they're using means. When it's dollars, you usually see medians. But so time spent in the post-acute care unit and the ward after the surgical procedure was the largest source of variation in the episode. And then standardizing suture anchor acquisition costs was felt to be a driver that could generate direct savings totaling about $217,000 across the hospitals. So by reducing the estimated duration variability, up to 640 care hours could be saved annually. And then standardizing suture anchors could result in savings of about $217,000. To put this into perspective, a lot of these hospitals are operating on a margin of like $150 million a year. So when we're talking about $200,000 or so dollars in savings versus $150 million margins, yeah, that just kind of seems like a drop in the ocean, really. The substantiation, I think, is a little bit limited here. It is I would consider it a restricted number of hospitals. In their conclusion, they say that this is a a multi-centered, high-powered study. I don't know what they mean by high-powered. It is a multi-center study, but a study of 2 is also a multi-center study, and a study of 1,000 is a multi-center study. The N here is probably more the center than it is the number of individuals. I wouldn't call 921 cases for a study like this particularly high volume. So I don't really know what they mean by high-powered. Like high-powered statistically, even then, 921 cases nested in 4 hospitals, I wouldn't consider to be high-powered. So I wouldn't look to that as a real selling point for this. And I would also consider that somewhat hyperbolic in stance. I think overall, the findings are probably just that, restricted to these 4 centers. How it compares to other literature is going to be more in the line of, do those other centers that previously considered their work operate like these ones? Or it's essentially just a different data point. I don't think it presents any higher level of evidence when it comes to these types of things. I think it makes sense that if you can reduce the amount of time that the patients are in the hospital or their PACU time, that's probably going to result in quicker discharge and maybe fewer costs as far as the salaries of the individuals who are paying attention to them in the PACU. I think it was interesting that volume was not really associated with the shorter episode duration, because the hospital with the 3rd highest volume also had the shortest episode duration. So I think there's a number of factors, some of which are probably unmeasurable, some of which they have to speak to culture and expectations, both on the stance of providers and administrators, clinicians, nurses, and the patients themselves that may be driving some of these things. What's your take?
It's interesting just because the costs of getting costs are hard, right? So, we're in a healthcare system now that does care about costs and listens to costs and is interested in delineating costs. I can see why cost-based studies are becoming of greater interest. I agree with all your points. I think this is something that if you're going to have multi-center, you should have like hundreds of hospitals, right, to understand costs. This is through Avant-Garde database, and they do have data from a lot of different hospitals. They've mostly paired with academic institutions, to my knowledge, but there's other hospitals that they pair with. And so it would be really nice to see this in a much broader scale. And obviously other procedures where cost might be much more impactful on the bottom line of a hospital. To your point, a suture anchor is expensive. It's not the end of the world. Now a total joint replacement, total shoulder replacement, spine hardware, those types of things will probably move the needle more. So I agree with your assessment. I would like to see this expanded a lot more and to understand what the impact would be before I would give it using it on a regular basis to move clinical practice needles.
All right. I think we're running short on time here. It's almost midnight, so we want to be there for the ball drop and not talking to you all. Let's get into the honorable mentions. We have thoracolumbar fracture, a natural history study of survival following injury by Striano and colleagues. We know these guys, myself included. This is a study that included 717 patients examining mortality within 3, 12, and 24 months following essentially thoracolumbar fractures. Really, the take-home message here is that there's an underappreciated mortality for these types of fractures that, when you're talking about, particularly in the insufficiency category, have generally been considered as, sort of treat the fracture and the patient will get over it and move on. But the fractures are associated with mortality risk comparable with that of hip fractures in the 3 to 24 months following injury. And this is greatest in the elderly, as you might expect, and those with multiple comorbidities. So some important information and a new paradigm opened as we begin this new year in the arena of thoracolumbar fractures. Next, we have clinical outcomes after 1 and 2 level lumbar total disc arthroplasty, 1,187 patients with 7 to 21 year follow-up by Marnay and colleagues. This one comes with a commentary, visual summary, and is permanently free. So a trifecta for you on the verge of 2025. This includes patients treated between 1999 and 2013, discloses the results in terms of ODI, BAS scores, and the individuals who required new surgery at another level or revision or reoperation at the index level. Overall, as you might expect, even with almost 1,200 patients, the rates of adverse events and revision surgery are pretty low in all groups. Total disc arthroplasty revision and an adjacent level surgery over the time window were 0.67 and 1.85% respectively. So the authors maintain this demonstrates the robust long-term clinical success of 1 and 2 level lumbar total disc arthroplasty over, you know, what amounts to 7 to 21 years. Definitely interesting information, and long-term follow-up is always welcome in these regards. It is permanently free, so definitely check it out. Then we have intraoperative facet joint block reduces pain after oblique lumbar interbody fusion, a double-blinded randomized placebo-controlled clinical trial by Ngo and colleagues, also with a commentary, so you can check out what others are thinking. This is a randomized controlled trial, had patients in 2 groups, 31 randomized to placebo and 30 were randomized to the treatment cohort. They received an intraarticular injection of a compound mixture of bupivacaine and triamcinolone. The use of this intraoperative facet block decreased pain perception during and obviously following the procedure, reducing opioid consumption and the severity of postoperative pain. This was also associated with a reduction in the length of stay. It is a randomized controlled trial. It is given level 1 evidence. Definitely something to consider in your practice if you're doing these types of oblique lumbar interbody fusions. That's about it for 2024 on this December 31st and for our January 1st issue of 2025. If you like what you heard and you aren't already subscribed, please do that and don't miss a single episode of Your Case is on Hold. Make it your New Year's resolution that you will not miss an episode of Your Case is on Hold in 2025. And you'll also listen to all the back issues from 2024, 2023, and 2022. If you don't know what we're talking about, with Kaiser Soze and Jackie Chiles and Soprano Paradigms and Terrence and Phillip and Ortho Bro C. Zachary Chadson. You got to listen to the back issues to get all of those Easter eggs. So I promise you're missing out if you aren't listening every 2 weeks. You're missing out if you're not reading these issues of JBJS. I'd like to thank everyone who's been an active listener and those who are growing our listening family and our listening audience. All the best to you and yours in 2025. Check us out in 2 weeks. We're about out of time here. The ball is dropping. It's a new year, but your case is still on hold.
Happy New Year, 2025.